Call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water, and actually before I open a public hearing, I want to announce that the recently created Subcommittee on Water Resources, which consists of Representative Smith and Representative Jensen, will be on a fact-finding trip to the Umatilla area this Friday. The public notice will go out sometime either late this afternoon or tomorrow morning, and they will be on a field trip there. But just wanted to acknowledge that for the record. And of course, Representatives Jensen and Smith are working on kind of water issues generally, but a particular eye towards the needs of that basin. So look forward to getting a report from them upon their return. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2859. And Representative Clem, if you want to present the bill to us.
I'm reading all the interesting testimony that you're going to hear from other people about my bill later. It's exciting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21. I'm here to talk about the Cougar Management Plan. I'm sorry.
We can do both.
I'm here to talk about groundwater and wells, and you're going to hear from a lot of people about this issue. You know, the way my bill is drafted is probably universally opposed by most, and that's fine. It will get the conversation started for you all about various levels, what the current average usage is of folks on wells domestically on an individual level and group. And I think the key that I would take home is, you know, don't get overly excited about the words on the page here and listen to what the public has to say about it. But I believe that there is a, for me personally, and I'm the chair of the Ag Natural Resources and Rural Communities, there is an issue about water availability. And so particularly in groundwater limited or critical groundwater areas, the land use system is only partially effective in sort of preserving an infrastructure, whether it's water availability, roads, and protections for farmers, and other systems that are important to agriculture also need to have integrity. So I would at least consider some options around sort of outright exemptions versus permitted exemptions, particularly in those groundwater limited areas where you've got major competition for a small amount of available water. And I think that's where you know, I'll leave it, because the bill basically says, you know, exempt single or group domestic wells, move their exemption from 15,000 down to 1,000. I think if you just did that, then you'd get 1,000 or 1,000 gallon wells instead of 115. So I'm not sure it solves the problem. But there are solutions out there, and I think you're going to hear some of them today, and I would encourage you to not only focus on problems with trying to do anything, but the fact that there is a real problem and there does need to be some solutions. And I think your vice chair subcommittee is working on that, in particular in one part of the world, in Oregon, but it's fairly severe here in Marion County in a couple areas. And the reason I even decided to introduce the bill came out of my experience in analyzing the county process for approving claims in what would otherwise be designated EFU areas under measures 37 and 49. And I know you're going to have testimony, because I can see some of the folks in the audience, exactly on that issue, and how to make sure that we do have water available before straws just get dipped into the earth, and then we just try and figure out after the fact, which is hard to do after the fact. So that's what I've got for you at the moment. I'm sorry I didn't get a bill that was just universally loved by all, but I welcome your involvement in trying to come up with some solutions to this particular challenge.
Thanks, Representative Clement. I really appreciate you bringing the bill forward. As you know, there was a related bill last session and considerable conversation around that during the 2007 session, and then again during the interim, where stakeholders got together to try to figure out a way to move forward on these exempt wells, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more today about the results of those conversations and ways that we might at least get a better handle on water, groundwater use in the state. So I know and appreciate your interest in the subject, and look forward to robust discussion and maybe moving something forward from this committee. Are there questions, Representative Boom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. maybe we could just do it for Marion County. Would that be okay?
I don't know. You got some people in the room on both sides of that equation, too, I'm guessing.
Any other questions?
If you did it for just critical groundwater limited and groundwater limited, there's not as many counties that have that little designation on the map, but there's some folks around Corbett who are in very bad shape on the map. They're I think in withdrawal stage of existing water rights in some cases, or if they're not, they're pretty close to it. So you got a few hot spots around the state.
And just a follow-up to before, in a part of my county they only allow two wells per year, and it's like so they manage it okay right now that way.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's good to see you, by the way. Any models or guideposts we can look at to help, in addition to the testimony we'll receive, any models or guideposts we can look to?
I haven't done my research on what other states do, but there's got to be some. I mean, there has to be some places that we know to be severely challenged. I certainly would work within sort of the existing water rights system and law. I mean, so in the Deschutes Basin, you've got a mitigation program that says if you're going to dip down, you have to replace with, three times, I think it is, or something like that, the number. So, I mean, that's something to look at. But I think the fundamental search should be somewhere where you've got a healthy, strong agricultural economy. If Orange County, California wasn't already paved over, I would say go look there, but that didn't work so well. So find a strong, healthy agricultural economy and residential pressures in places that don't have land use planning, and see what they're doing to not have the residential pressures crowd out agricultural water usage. Our land use planning system largely solves these problems for us, with some exceptions when you get into aberrations to it. But that's where I would go searching if it were me.
Cool, thank you.
Great, thanks.
Yeah,
thanks very much.
And back to the land use committee.
Let's hear now from Doug Woodcock and Brenda Bateman from the Water Resources Department. And my understanding is the department doesn't have a position on this particular bill, but we did ask them to provide some background on the exempt well and groundwater issues related to exempt wells. So a good chance to get sort of informational questions answered from folks who know.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department, and I just want to draw your attention to the materials that are in front of you this afternoon. There's a set of PowerPoint slides that we'll be using. There's also a one-page briefer that we've put together during the past year on the exempt use wells, their definitions, and some basic statistics in Oregon. And then third, there's a summary, a four-page summary of the results from an exempt use workshop that was convened during 2008 by then Representative, now Senator Dingfelder, and hosted by the Policy Consensus Center at Portland State University. So some of the participants of those events and some of the key results are attached there.
And with me this afternoon. Sorry, Brenda, before you start, presentation about 10 minutes, does that sound about?
Yes, sir.
Will that work with a little bit of time to follow up? Great, thanks.
With me this afternoon is Doug Woodcock. He is our manager of our groundwater hydrology section at the department.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Today I'm here to talk to you about groundwater uses and the wells that serve them. So this will be a very brief introduction into the world of exempt uses in groundwater. So today we're just going to talk about the exempt use statute, a little bit about water use, a bit about well development, and then talk about just a few of the exempt use issues. So 537-545 establishes the list. It has three parts to it. It establishes the list of exempt use groundwater uses. Part 2 establishes the right of exempt groundwater uses, and Part 3 establishes the means of documenting the priority date for those uses. So in Section 1, just a list of the exempt groundwater uses, the stock watering, lawn, and non-commercial garden, schools in critical groundwater areas, single and group domestic. So just the list of allowed groundwater uses that are exempt from the permitting process. Of those, three of them stand out as being the most predominant. These are the most common of the exempt groundwater uses. Lawns and non-commercial garden up to 1/2 acre. Single or group domestic purposes not exceeding 15,000 gallons per day. And industrial or commercial uses not to exceed 5,000 gallons a day. By the way, each one of these are distinct and separate exemptions. And I raise that because the issue of the domestic exemption oftentimes is confused with the half-acre lawn and non-commercial garden as being the same exemption, and those are two different exemptions. Section 2 of the exempt use statute, the use of groundwater.
Wait, can I clarify something, though? It is permissible if to use water obtained from a well under the single or group domestic purpose exemption for lawn or garden watering, is it not?
So, yeah. Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
An individual well is allowed to use each one of these exemptions.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
So Section 2 identifies that the use of groundwater for a use exempt under subsection 1 to the extent that it is beneficial constitutes a right to appropriate groundwater equal to that established by a groundwater rights certificate. So this tells us that an exempt use user carries the same weight, or at least that use carries the same weight as a certificate and the same responsibilities. So just at the big picture of exempt uses here, no application is required for exempt uses. I've heard in public meetings that it's an exempt use, therefore it's exempt from regulation. Well, that's not true. It's exempt from having to file, exempt from having to go through the permitting process. That's what makes it an exempt use. There's no permit or certificate issued. They constitute a water right with a priority date. Must be beneficial use without waste. Regulation is consistent with other water rights. That means that it is subject to regulation. And there's no review of water availability. That is, when somebody files a groundwater permit for a use outside of exempt uses, we would take the time to look through that, and we're required to look at this, and identify the water availability. Is the proposed use within the capacity of the resource? Is there a potential for interference with existing users? Is there hydraulic connection with local streams nearby? Is there a potential for substantial interference? Those are all things that we look at in the review process. The exempt uses are not part of that process. So very quickly, this slide shows, this is from a 2000 article from the USGS, estimated water use in Oregon, and it identifies 993 million gallons a day on average at that time, 80% of which was irrigation. 7% was identified as being domestic use, and that domestic use in this report was called out specifically self-supplied domestic use. So that does not include municipalities providing the water or water districts. These would be individuals supplying their own water, and this is just the groundwater component. So look at these numbers, 80% for irrigation, 7% for the domestic use. But now let's look at the wells that actually serve those two uses here. When you break that out, this slide has been filtered of, and these numbers have been filtered for everything but new wells. So this is represents new wells in the state of Oregon, and this is our well log database where I got this information. And it shows us that 85% of the water wells that we've received, the water well logs that we've received in Oregon, are for domestic use. That's an exempt use. For the irrigation component, right here, is 7%. So what that's telling us is that 85% of the wells essentially serve 7% of the water in Oregon for the domestic piece anyway. And then 7% of the irrigation essentially is a very small number in the number of wells in Oregon that serve that 80% of the water used. So what does that look like when it's distributed across the state? First of all, look back, you know, we're almost 250,000 well logs in Oregon, and that's all uses. So back in 1955, the Groundwater Act required that water well logs, the reports when a well is drilled, be submitted to the department. So this particular slide shows Oregon with our groundwater limited areas and our critical areas identified on the map. But keep in mind that many of those boundaries were adopted in 1990, say. A few of them in the 70s, but most of these were in the 90s. And so they don't really reflect, as we go through time here, they don't reflect the development in those areas. But the point is the legend up here, the blue dots represent 1 to 16 wells per section of land. That's 1 square mile. So as the colors get a little bit hotter into the bright yellow here, there's more than 320 wells per section of land. So we're going to step through the decades here. This is 1955. We had about 4,600 water well reports. This is 1965 at about 27,000 water well reports. Again, these are new wells. And you can see how the well development is occurring here. It's mostly in the lowlands. You know, the Willamette Valley is well developed. Jackson, Josephine County, the Klamath Lowlands over here, starting to get some well logs over in the Deschutes Basin. So as time goes on, watch how the distribution changes on these. This is 1975. We're up to 80,000 wells. We're starting to get some color in here, too. So we're showing quite a few more wells per section of land here. 1985, almost 140,000 wells. 1995, 184,000 wells. 2005, almost 230,000 wells. And look, we've almost lost the entire coast range at this point. So the distribution we're seeing well development, largely domestic wells, growing up the flanks of the valleys up onto the hills here. And then this is up to December of 2008, just under 250,000 well reports. And in this area, the predominant, Willamette Valley, Josephine, Jackson County, the Deschutes Basin, Lapine really stands out right here with a lot of wells per section. So let's compare that to water right wells. So this is just a map of wells with water rights on them, a little over 23,000 wells. So that's quite a contrast from one to the other. So if we go back to this, you can see that if you extracted out those 23,000 well logs, it wouldn't change this map a whole lot. What you're looking at in this water well density is largely exempt uses across the map here. So I'd just like to close with some issues that have been identified. Brenda spoke to you of the working group that took place last year. Here were some uses that we identified that we brought to the table as part of that working group. 15,000 gallons a day for single or group domestic. That gets a lot of people's ire up, but it's really a misperception problem because that is a ceiling. That is an upper allowed use. It's not a mandate. So when somebody develops a tax lot and they want to use exempt use, they can use up to 15,000 gallons a day beneficially. But how much is actually used? Indoor use is typically 200 to 300 gallons a minute. It's not very much water. But there is the outdoor piece, too. You know, people want to do, you know, they want to hose off the driveway and whatnot. You know, perhaps that elevates it a little bit. But the domestic piece by itself is a pretty small quantity of water. The misperception piece is that when lands are subdivided up, we often will get phone calls that say, you know, all of my neighbors are going to start using 15,000 gallons a day each for their domestic use, and we have to explain to them that, no, that's not true. That's what they're allowed to use up to the ceiling beneficially.
And you, and sorry, Mr. Woodcock, you either misspoke or I misheard you, because a typical indoor use is 200 to 300 gallons per day.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Substantial interference. So the issue of interference between wells, that is, that does happen, even at the exempt use level. So these are some pretty small quantities of water that can be used, but you saw the map. The wells can sit pretty close together, and, you know, when I worked down in Josephine County as an assistant watermaster, we had 5 and 6 wells on the same acre of land. So we had wells that were just tens of feet apart. So there's a lot of interference between each other on that. So it is something that happens, but it's generally associated with that outdoor water use piece. So when people want to be irrigating their lawn and garden, that's when the real interference seems to show up. Specific well location information is lacking for exempt use wells. So take a 40-acre parcel. A well report is submitted, and it could have very good information on it, you know, township, range, section, quarter, and tax lot. But as that lot is divided into 10 more acres, we have no idea which tax lot that well ultimately ends up on, because we only had it identified to the original 40-acre lot. So it would be helpful if we could get to an improved well location on exempt wells. Half-acre exemption is limited only by benefit of use. And by that I mean that our other uses generally have a volume associated with them. Domestic, 15,000 gallons a day. Commercial use, 5,000 gallon exemption. But with half-acre lawn and garden, it's a half an acre. So it's whatever they can use beneficially on that half acre. So when our water master gets called out because a neighbor is claiming to have a water problem, all the water master can do is measure off that irrigated acreage and make sure it's within the half acre. They could be using twice as much water as they need to, but if it's not running off down the street, there really isn't a lot that he can do, because they're using the water within that half acre. So well proximity to streams is a real but complicated issue. The concern is that as we evaluate groundwater applications, we might identify a hydraulic connection issue and recommend not issuing the permit. Exempt uses, there is no oversight, and the well may go near a stream. But just because a well is near a stream does not mean it's tapped into the same source as that stream. It could be developing a resource that is below that stream. And so it's not quite as straightforward as it sounds, but it is a real issue and an issue of concern. So with that, I would open it up for questions.
Questions? I have a couple. One, I was interested to see that there you establish, or someone establishes, priority dates for these wells. So despite the fact that they have not undergone a permitting process, they are treated essentially like a water right with a priority date. Does this also mean that in the case of water shortages for more senior users, you would have the authority to shut a well down or limit withdrawals from a well?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. They are treated like any other water right. They have a priority date based upon the date of the well construction. So that is their established date. So when there is competition between two users, the priority date determines who ultimately gets their water.
And how do you know, without this application, without the permitting process, you're relying on their start card fees, the well drilling fee, the well drilling permits or applications to know roughly where they are and when they were drilled?
Mr. Chair, the statute is specific that the priority date is based upon the date of construction on the well report. So that is the first thing we look to. In the absence of a well report, they could also submit power records or some other information that would identify when their use began.
I guess this is a comment. It strikes me as odd, and there are many odd features of Oregon water law, but certainly odd that while a well could be shut off because of its impacts on senior water right holders, there is no review process for the establishment of a well in the first place. Right? That if the principle is we want to make sure that senior water right holders receive the water to which they're entitled under our priority system, it's odd that there isn't a review of whether water is available in the first place. So I just throw that comment out, and I'm sure that we'll hear testimony on that and other issues. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The proposed legislation that brings us here today suggests a reduction from 15,000 gallons to 1,000, but you're indicating that the average use is 300 to 500 gallons a day. So what does this legislation accomplish for us?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the average use that I quoted was a household use. That was the domestic piece. There is another piece there that would be the outdoor, that the other large piece that might be the outdoor lawn and garden piece. That is not included in the legislation before us. The legislation before us is specific to the domestic piece. So this reducing it down to 1,000 gallons a day could have an effect on some users, some exempt users. Specifically, one that comes to mind might be folks that use open-loop heat source, ground source heat pumps, excuse me. And these would be systems that extract water from a well and run it through a heat exchanger and then discharge that water. That is water that would be considered under the domestic exemption, but would certainly exceed the number that I gave you earlier of a typical domestic use. So those uses, as I understand it from the state of Washington, who works with these pretty closely, small homes would be served by these up to the tune of some 5,000 gallons a day.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I see that, just as a note, and then we asked a different question, but I see that both the half acre and the downhole heat exchange are not included in the proposed changes before us at this moment. But perhaps you could comment on the two issues. First, the water availability analysis as it's currently being used for water rights, and how you would, if someone suggested that be used for domestic well purposes, how much cost, and also the standards, because if I recall correctly, they're aggressive standards as we now use them for water right purposes. And the second question has to do with interference and how much it costs to actually prove it. So when you go out to shut somebody off, if there is interference, what actually really happens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the full permitting process that we go through right now, yes, is an in-depth review. So if exempt users were subjected to the same process, then we would, as I mentioned earlier, we would analyze for the stability of the resource. So are the water levels stable in the area? Is the proposed use within the capacity of the resource? Is there a potential for interference with existing users and the hydraulic connection with streams? So if they were subjected to the same process, then a determination of each of those points would come out of the process. There's been no recommendation that they be subject to that process at this time. Currently, it's about a day-long process. It's about an eight-hour process for groundwater hydrology staff to collate the information necessary to evaluate a proposed use for each of those items. So there's some effort and cost in doing that. The second piece of that, how much is the cost to prove interference, involves actually someone being out there on site. The first step is, whenever there's a regulation piece there or an interference piece, let's take the example of two users that are currently competing for the resource. One user complains to the water master that they're not getting their customary permitted quantity of water. The water master does the groundwork, the field work, locates the wells on a map, identifies all of the well logs, gathers all that information up, comes to the groundwater hydrology section where we put a scientist on it to actually determine whether it's whether they're in the same aquifer or not, first of all, based upon the available information. And then, if it looks like, yes, there's a potential for interference here, this needs to be further investigated, then that scientist will go out and actually do a flow test on the well to determine whether there's an efficiency issue, determine whether it's a pump problem with the complainant's well. And then lastly, they would actually turn on the well and determine whether they can identify interference with that other well. So it could take all of a day. It may take longer if the wells are far apart.
Thank you.
Great. We're going to move on, and we have a number of folks signed up to testify in another bill yet to hear. So thanks to you both, and I'll ask that subsequent folks are brief in their testimony, and I will be limiting you to about 4 minutes. So that should enable us to get through the list here. And let's start with Jeff Stone and Sean Cleave, if we could, if they're in the...
They're here.
Jeff's here.
Mr. Cleave is next door.
All right, why don't you begin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'm before you today to talk about House Bill 2859 and how Oregon's nursery and greenhouse industry, which is your largest sector of ag, is concerned about groundwater as a primary source of irrigation water. Because of this dynamic that you've already heard, OAN members are concerned about the impact of exempt wells on nursery operations. As the number of exempt wells increase, we anticipate more frequent problems with water availability and increased claims of water interference between exempt wells and irrigated wells. In my testimony, I have a number of solutions for you that, or at least our thoughts about the exempt well issue. The one thing I would point out is that the 1,000-gallon level seems awfully low to us. And, in fact, I've talked to Representative Clem about that number. Our suggestion is 3,000, but I wouldn't say that my guess is based in any type of fact or science. But it just seemed reasonable to us that a number that is more closely aligned with that would be more inclusive of a number of different uses. The reason that I'm before you today is the Water Resources Department has a lot to deal with already, and exempt wells is not going to be the silver bullet that helps solve all the water problems. However, it does not serve my industry, which is very water-dependent, to allow an area to go groundwater critical, and then water is shut off. That's a recipe for us to be out of business very quickly. Plus, it doesn't help solve the overall problem that you're trying to address with a number of water issues. So I can either go through an interpretive dance until Mr. Cleave comes here or conclude my remarks.
Not necessary to dance, although that might be interesting for another time.
I'm sorry to horrify the committee by that visual.
Let's go ahead and have Laurel Hines and Liz Frankel.
Oh,
Mr. Cleave. So hang on just a minute. And Sean, are you ready and able to step up here for testimony?
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, thank you for obliging me. I'm doing double duty today. Usually water is Mrs. Fast's issue, but unfortunately she couldn't be here today. She's in Eastern Oregon meeting with some Farm Bureau members. For the record, Sean Cleave representing Oregon Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau, in relation to exempt wells, is very concerned that the Water Resource Department has a process that is in place to protect groundwater-limited areas of the state from conflicts regarding water rights. This issue obviously has come up before. SFAST made me aware of a bill that was introduced last session that she had worked on, House Bill 2566, that was from the 2007 Legislative Assembly's work group. That bill had specific language that the Farm Bureau would be very interested in seeing incorporated into this bill, namely regarding a permitting within the Water Resources Department. There would be a fee associated with those permits, and those permits would address all new wells in those limited areas. I'll be happy to provide a copy of that bill to the committee for the record, and also some formal testimony, which unfortunately I wasn't able to get put together before today's hearing. So,
so if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the Farm Bureau would be probably more enthusiastic about an approach that required permitting on wells in groundwater limited or groundwater critical areas.
For all new wells.
For all new wells in those in those areas. Okay, and that looks closer to the bill that we considered last session.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Any questions for these folks? Seeing none, you're excused.
Thank you.
You can go back to the other committee if you prefer, or stick around here.
I think I'll stay in this one. I'm usually in that one. So.
All right. Let's now hear from Laurel Hines and Liz Frankel. And Dave Moskowitz, why don't you come on up as well? We'll make this a threesome. Liz, do you want to join this panel? Thanks.
Do you want me to
go start? Ahead? Yeah.
Okay. My name is Laurel Hines, and I live in Marion County. And I, first of all, I want to acknowledge Representative Clem's efforts in this. I think because of his involvement in Measure 49 last year, he heard testimony from Todd Jarvis of the Institute for Water and Watersheds and at Oregon State University, and all the other issues about groundwater limited areas. And I really think something needs to be done, and I really admire him for bringing this up. I just don't agree with the proposed solution. It's far too limited in its scope. But the other thing I want to recommend first off is that as you're debating these issues, that you get information from Todd Jarvis from the Institute of Water and Watersheds. He has, I've been to several presentations by him.
Ms. Hines, I'm sorry to interrupt. Did you introduce yourself for the record? Could you do that?
Oh, yes. Laurel Hines, Marion County.
Go ahead.
And Todd Jarvis has, in his presentations, he's talked about studying how they handle the huge increases in rural residential exempt wells in other states. So I think he could give you a lot of insight and suggestions on how to deal with this. I also wanted to clarify that when the Water Resources staff were talking about how they handle issues when there's interference with wells and when one well possibly goes dry because of another. From my understanding, that becomes a huge problem for the person whose well goes dry, because even if Water Resources can prove that a newer well has impacted the senior well, they usually make the senior well deepen first, which is a huge expense to the landowner. And in the area where I live, in a groundwater limited areas, there's more and more, just 2 weeks ago, yet another one fell to this issue, more and more wells are going so deep that they reach high salinity. And when you reach high salinity, this is an area you need to pursue and ask Water Resources more about, because what I've been told by the company that we have that deals with iron in our water and that sort of thing, that when you get high salinity, it can impact your health, but mostly you can't water anything outside unless you have salt-resistant plants. It'll kill things if the saline is high enough. And to desalinate the water, you waste 50% of the water. So if you have a low-producing area where you only have like 3 gallons a minute, you have almost nothing left. So that's a big issue. My general objection to the proposed solution is that I believe that even though a solution is badly needed for the large number of exempt wells, as was discussed, the proposed solution of 1,000 gallons will not stop large subdivisions. For example, if you have a subdivision attempting to be in a groundwater limited area, and say there's 40 or 50 lots, you would still get 40 or 50 wells at 1,000 gallons a minute. That would still be 40,000 gallons a minute of additional water being used without any study required. And a lot of these subdivisions, from my understanding, are seeking to do individual wells so that the developer doesn't have to be responsible for whether people get water or what kind of problems occur in the future. The other thing is that there's no provision for policing how much people use. There's nothing in this bill that gives water resources the money or ability to go out and limit people to how much they use. And I'm not going to go into all the details about what qualifies me as a commenter. I'm basically sort of self-made groundwater advocate. I've been following groundwater for about 20 years. I've been constantly going to hearings and the different things and studying the Marion County Groundwater Ordinance. And I've been involved in several land use fights, and one of which is, many of you may have seen it on the Channel 2 News last year, where my local homeowners association and people in my area have spent $30,000, more than that by now, of fighting a Measure 37 claim that, and we still haven't heard the decision, they're still trying to get vested, to put 40, I think it's about 40 home sites in an EFU area, in a groundwater limited area. And we fought it. Our hydrogeologist said there wasn't enough water, that it would be a risky situation unless an extensive study was done to determine the future situation. And the county's peer reviewer, their own contracted peer reviewer, agreed with that decision, but the county agreed to let them go forward anyway, and we're still waiting to hear whether they get vested or not.
Well, thank you very much for your advocacy on the issue and for being here today.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you to wrap it up. Gone over my four-minute allotment for you, and if you could just last couple of words.
Okay. Well, I hope you read my summary, but basically 1,000 gallons is not adequate in terms of people in small acreages, stock watering, which, as you saw, was allowed, having small gardens, small vegetable gardens, that sort of thing, and when there's problems with water quality that need recharge in the evening that wastes a lot of water. So I really think 1,000 gallons is an unreasonable amount.
Thank you.
I'm Liz Frankel, and I'm with the League of Women Voters. We testified in the 2000 session in support of recording all new domestic wells for domestic household use. The 2007 bill, HB 2566, was the result of compromise legislation, which passed the House, modifying the exempt well statute. As we in Oregon face not only potential problems with drought, but existing problems of water shortage, there's a critical need to know how and where the waters of this state are being used. We support reducing the threshold for exemption from 15,000 gallons, which seems a much more reasonable domestic use. I must say the 1,000 gallon, it's the concept of reducing what is a ridiculous amount. However, it would seem prudent to give the water resources more flexibility to manage exempt wells in dire situations, such as in designated critical groundwater areas. This seems to us a major problem. This is not a solution. It's almost like an iconic approach to what is a very severe lack of ability to regulate in this state. Now, I'm just going to add one little thing. She was talking about Marion County. In Benton County, we have been struggling and have gotten to the point where we actually require evidence of water availability before you can sink a well. We're just a little tiny county. When you saw those maps and all those dots, we're a little tiny county, but we're trying. I don't think this should be a situation where counties have to deal with this. This ought to be a statewide approach. It is foolish to count on the counties. They don't have the money, the staff, a lot of things. That's the end of my testimony, and thank you very much. The League has been working on water steadily for a year now. We're into our second phase, and I'm sure you've all gotten a copy of our publication.
I have. Thank you, Ms. Frankel. Dave.
Thank you. My name is David Moskowitz, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, we're very interested in addressing the issues that this bill raises. Exempt groundwater it's crying out for reform in this state. And there's also a very strong tie to land use issues that the groundwater tied to land use issues needs reform as well. But that's not the subject of this bill. In the past, Water Watch has been for closing this exemption completely. That's not our position at this time. We don't want to fight with Oregonians in Action or the realtors or the home builders. What we need here are resources for the department to manage this public resource. Our testimony talks about a couple of things. We'd like to register all exempt wells, and that would be going back to existing wells, all 230,000 of them. We'd like registration to go on in the future as well. There needs to be a modest fee applied to give the department the resources to manage these wells. Representative Smith asked the question, are there any models out there? Is anyone else doing this? The state of Washington is looking at this right now, and it's my understanding that New Mexico and Utah may have state statutes that address this, and I'm going to do some more research. I didn't have time to confirm that, but I'd like to get back to the committee on that there may be some examples out there in other states. The cumulative effect, I think the issue, Representative Clem is to be commended for bringing this issue forward. However, reducing the amount from 15,000 to 1,000, it may not be really that much of an issue when the department is saying that most of these domestic uses, which are 85% of the wells, are using 200 to 300 gallons a day for domestic use. The cumulative effect of that, if there's 230,000 wells out there, that's about 7 million gallons a day. But when you start adding some of these other uses, the half-acre lawn, which has no volume cap, the 5,000 gallons for light industrial use, stock watering, when you start adding all those up, this is a significant amount of water. And with an additional 3,000 to 4,000 wells a year, although that number may be down with the housing market the way it is, you're still increasing the pressure on this scarce resource. The department needs tools to manage this. We don't want to get rid of the exemption. But water, I think someone who sinks an exempt well gets a priority date. They receive, and they don't have to apply for the water right. So they get a priority date from the department, and they haven't paid into the system at all. It's time to change that. It's time to register these, to find out where they are, and it's time to charge them a moderate, modest fee so the department has the ability to manage the conflicts, which are going to increase. This is an area crying out for reform, and the farmers, people who have put their time and energy into getting water rights, are going to have those rights diminished, as if this problem is not reined in. We don't want to stop the exemption. We just want to give the department tools, and a registration and a fee have to be part of that. I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee, and I'll get back to you with some answers on the other.
Thanks. Any questions for this panel? All right. Seeing none, well, thank you for testifying. And let's bring up the next group, which will include, is Richard Kosis in the room? Yep. Hi. Jerry Schmidt, Sean Jillians.
Thank you.
In any order, gentlemen. Sean, you may have sat down first.
Wow, racing up here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'll try and be brief, Mr. Chair. I did want to thank Representative Jensen, though, as a young law graduate who had just passed the bar. I had an interview with the chair of the House Water Committee here in Oregon, and he asked me pointedly if I had any background in water law, and I said, and he may remember this, you should hire someone from Lewis and Clark if that's what you would like. Fortunately for me, he didn't make that choice, but here I am before you instead of suing the IRS, my chosen career path. On the issue, thank you, Representative, on the issue of domestic wells, I think the department did a great job of giving an overview of the work group that we had this past interim, and we did have some very open discussions and lengthy discussions in that. I think the points that I would take away from those discussions, one, you saw the statistic that only 7% of all groundwater usage is attributed to domestic wells. If you go out to all water usage in Oregon, it's 1%. That's according to the USGS. 1% is domestic wells. So while we may agree that there might be some issues with groundwater concerns, we're tackling the tiniest of bites if we really want to openly discuss groundwater and its usage. A second point I'd make, Mr. Chair, is that the Oregon Water Resources Commission does have authority to limit domestic well exemptions in critical groundwater areas. That was part of the discussions we had in the work group, and the department did inform us of that. Another issue that we talk about is the cap of 15,000 and whether or not it should be lowered. And Mr. Doug did a great job of talking about it's not how much people typically use because you're still subject to beneficial use. So you can't just open your faucet in your house or, you know, flush your toilet 300 times a day. It's beneficial use. So while we could talk about lowering your number or not, the realistic use is the beneficial use, and that's the 200 to 300 gallons that you hear typically in a typical house. An issue with the bill as it's currently drafted is the 1,000 blanket from 15,000 down to 1,000 and including single and group wells. We should be encouraging group wells, not discouraging them, and having a single well in there with a system rather than having 15 holes in the ground seems counterproductive at best. The last thing I took away from the department's presentation, both in our interim work group and again today, is the slide indicated that substantial interference does occasionally occur, though not frequently, and it's typically not associated with domestic wells. If we really want to get into the discussion of groundwater usage, everything should be out there in the discussions. And during the work group, we tried to go that route. We limited it that was not the route that everyone decided to pursue, and we limited it to domestic wells. And we didn't have a lot of consensus around that, one, because we couldn't see what the actual problem was we were trying to address, and two, the impacts that these actually have. And I think you see that the proposals we supported was allowing the department more resources to actually determine the impacts that domestic wells have. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. Let's go ahead and hear from Mr. Kosasan or Mr. Schmidt.
But the chair recognizes you.
But you, Richard, go ahead.
Richard Kosasan, Water for Life. Echoing previous comments, I think one of the things to keep in mind with exempt uses is the 15,000 gallons a day is an artificial lever. It's artificial as 10,000 gallons a day would be, as 5,000 gallons a day would be, as 1,000 gallons a day would be. It is an artificial threshold, and that's all that it is. But indeed, I would encourage people to take a look at the potential to use more than 1,000 gallons. John Q. lives in a rural setting. He uses, say, 300 gallons for a domestic household. He uses 750 gallons outside irrigating the yard. He's a participant in a rural fire district. He fills a fire truck. That's once every 3 months. He also maintains a spray truck. He fills the spray truck. Has he exceeded a threshold? Probably. Has he exceeded the 15,000 gallons? Probably not. So I think it is for the exception. It is not for the rule. And I think that should be taken very close review of. And again, if one were to look at, quote, the use of water and the beneficial use of water, referring to the statutes pertaining to groundwater, specifically the policy. Beneficial use is the basis, measure, and extent of the right. So to suggest that someone in a rural setting is wastefully neglecting the use and the prudent use of the water, I think, is a misconception. Keep in mind, who is probably has the built-in incentive to be more conscious, more aware of conservation of that resource? The rural individual on that well or the municipal user? Suggesting that if you overuse, you wastefully use, you could damage your well, you could dry your well, you have a built-in incentive to be very cautious and maintain the highest degree of conservation that you can with that well. I would take a look at the question that has been brought up in terms of water availability. If you look at new wells going out in rural lands, the individual that buys the 2-acre parcel or their 5-acre parcel, one of the contingencies on the purchase of that land, most of the time, is on one thing, a drilling of the well and finding of adequate water. So in terms of the argument that water availability is never considered, I don't think that is a prudent course. In terms of the activities of the last year, I too, I guess, had a wonderful opportunity to participate on a work group, consensus group, coordinated in part by PSU Consensus Group. And I think at the end of the day, the group came down with two thoughts. One is the department needed some tools for enhanced research. I think most people agreed with that. And the question of funding. Question of funding is a question, I think, that will probably revert back to the state budget. In my testimony, written testimony, I would encourage also the committee to look at references to Umatilla County. I think it was 2004, the Water Resources Commission designated a critical groundwater area in Umatilla County. Local individuals put together a task force. The task force went to work. I think they worked for well over a year period of time. What they came to the conclusion is that in terms of drawdown of the groundwater resource in Umatilla County, it was not a factor and it was not attributed to domestic wells. It was that of other users. In essence, they exempted the exempt wells again.
I'll ask you to wind it up, Richard.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you.
That'll work.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. I didn't give you written testimony. I gave you pictures. I only deal in pictures. What I did was take part of Doug's testimony and put it in a graph so that you could immediately see the total water use in Oregon, how it works out in a pie chart, and then looking at a further breakdown of the small piece of pie that represents groundwater in the total use, you can see the further breakdown of what the uses are in Oregon. The reason why domestic has never hit the top of the charts is because it is such a small, minute, de minimis use that it's never hit the top of the charts. And one of the reasons that we've kind of put it aside is because we are trying to give the department the tools necessary to do the bigger picture, which is the majority of the water use in Oregon, how they can regulate it, how they can keep it for future generations. The second part of the material I gave you is a statewide water needs assessment that the department just got done with. I know that Representative Smith likes those kind of research type things. So that's 229 pages long. I just gave you a few pages out of it so that you didn't have to look at 229 pages. But there is some very good information there about the demand forecasts and what the department sees in the future. Frankly, the department does have the tools. You've heard some discussion about groundwater limited areas. Why they're limited is they pull the major uses off the system, and they no longer give the larger permitted uses out there. That's to slow down the water declines. It's worked rather successfully. They have another tool in the tool basket if they need it. They can actually declare it a critical area. They haven't done that in a number of years because it seems like they've been able to slow down these withdrawals to the point that they've stabilized the resource. I don't have a whole lot of extra things to add. This is a bill, as you've heard, that there's a lot of emotional discussion about the land use issues that come up in this particular process. I hope we keep all the land use in that next committee next door. We're trying to concentrate on water issues here. One of the reasons why we're seeing exempt uses, in Oregon law prior to 1955, there was an absolute ownership. In other words, they had the English rule of law. In other words, if you had a water right on your own property, you were able to use that water. It later, through time, came an American rule of law which allowed only reasonable use rather than outright absolute use. So you can see that that's kind of how it generated itself. We do have the information about across the state lines of various types of water use. That is available. It is available through the consensus group. So if you need that type of information, it was presented to us in the work group with all the different states surrounding us. It goes from more than what we do to less. We're about in the middle. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your time and members of the committee.
Thanks, Jerry. Are there questions for this panel? Before you run off, I did have one question, which is it your view, and any of you can answer this, that the department has the resources and information necessary in order to manage sort of groundwater assets of the state, including for domestic use? So do they have the information they need in order to investigate potential claims of interference related to groundwater withdrawals, to adjudicate those claims where there's a senior right holder who says they're losing their water? It's partly a resource question, which is not, you know, exactly the issue in front of this committee, but it's also partly an informational question. They testified that, you know, if a lot is subdivided, then they don't even know who owns the well. Is it your view that they have all the tools that they need?
Go ahead. Thank you. May I use 2 minutes of Jerry's time? Mr. Chair, I believe they have the tools. If one were to look at the provisions in terms of a groundwater limited area, 536.340, they can classify as they so choose. In terms of a critical groundwater area, 537.730, which establishes that process procedure for the designation. In terms of withdrawal, if they find an area throughout the state that is under critical stress or duress, they can withdraw the waters, including exempt uses under 536.410. In terms of managing, regulating existing wells, they have that authority under 537.775. In terms of the secondary question of resources, which is an interesting question, which probably is going to be in front of Ways and Means. I think the consensus group, Mr. Chair, reached close consensus on the question of providing or assisting the department in terms of the provision of additional resources for additional research, adequate objective research that could be used to answer some of these questions. But again, one of the underlying questions in terms of artificially moving a gallonage limitation is the only way if you drop the limitation to a different standard. The only way you can test compliance is to go measure that water use. I would suggest that that probably would not go over well in a lot of rural areas of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jerry Schmidt again for the record. My answer to that is, and you were looking specifically at some of the research issues and whether or not that has the adequate information. I agree with Richard. They have the tools. Do they have the adequate information? I don't think so. Part of the problem has been throughout the years that they've decreased their well network. They have a well network, which is a term that they use for measuring water levels throughout the state. At one time, they had over 1,000 wells on that well net. They're down to 300 and plus wells now that they maintain and accurately measure the water levels. That's the only way you can tell over a period of time whether or not aquifers are truly declining, other than using models, which are computer models, which tend to try and project what's happening. Those hydrographs will actually reveal what's happening. So I'm encouraging, I'm trying to encourage every legislative session to boost that well net so that we have a long-term well network to find out what's happening with the resource. For instance, Parrot Mountain, they did a very exhaustive study there thinking that there was a huge water issue. It turns out it wasn't. It was climate-related, and as soon as the rains came back, the wells came back. So a lot of these issues can be settled by looking at long-term hydrographs, and they don't have some of that data, and that's one of the things they do need. And you asked about location. I think they do give accurate locations and ownership of the wells. The problem is, as Doug mentioned, that as these parcels get smaller, the actual identification gets rather difficult. So we've encouraged Doug to go to the commission and to their groundwater advisory committee and bring that issue up and see if there's a way of solving that issue.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Let's conclude with Jim Welsh and John Chandler.
Well, I didn't save the best for last.
We'll save the best for last, Mr. Chair. Jim Welsh, representing Oregon Cattlemen, and I also provided some very similar testimony for Oregon State Grange. They do have an agreement in this, and committee members. We served on the exempt well work group, and we just cannot support this type of legislation. We think it's rather drastic, rather extreme, going from 15,000 for exempt use, beneficial use, to 1,000. Rather drastic. Although there were those on the in the work group that wanted to do that, they liked this legislation. There were also those that wanted to require measuring or metering of all diversions and to require a water rights certificate for groundwater, and especially for those even in exempt well use as exempt well users. And the cattlemen and a lot of those in agriculture do understand how a water rights certificate, that process is very elongated and extensive and expensive, and they don't want to go through that for domestic use. And really the question here is, and has been from the time we started in 2007 discussing this, what is the problem we're looking for a solution for? And if this particular bill is a solution, then where is the research and data to support this? And is there scientific information available to support reducing from 15,000 to 1,000? And we know that there isn't at this point in time, and that this is an arbitrary number. And we did hear from Representative Klim that is true. This is a bill to start the discussion. I must say we already had the discussion, and the cattlemen believe that the Water Resource Department has the tools, as you already heard. We agree they have the tools to address any critical water problems, groundwater limited areas, and I'd again urge you to take a look at Umatilla and the Deschutes area and how the local stakeholders came together to solve their problems. Great examples. and evidence that our system in the state for water use is working. And they were backed up with great information and help from the Water Resources Department in solving their problems. And to finish off real quick, in my area, my wife and I have lived 30 years now in a forest interface area, 5 acres, and we've had geothermal water use for our heat pump. We didn't like that process. We were re-injecting it in the ground, but it wasn't as efficient as a closed loop, so we changed that. We really restrict our garden watering. I know how much for the amount of and the soil type and the plants that we have, and I restrict that watering, you know, on a weekly basis and for the type of weather that we're having and everything else. And during the summer, myself and my neighbors, most all of us let our grass around the house go dry. It just turns brown. We don't water that because we know that there could be problems that associated with overuse. I just don't think there's a real critical problem out in the rural areas. Everybody I know of is quite aware that overusage, and we don't even get close to 15,000. And watering, I figured that watering 3 times a week and just using our domestic usage, we would be somewhere at 500 gallons at the very most a day. So,
thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association also as the proud owner of a currently exempt domestic water well. And I just, unlike my colleague here, as soon as I heard this bill got scheduled, I went back home and turned on all my outside spigots so I can get to my 15,000 gallon a day usage before it got lowered. Since my members are the ones who are building the houses, or were building houses, we're not doing so much anymore, to the extent that those are being used for domestic water on domestic water wells, we're the 7% of the situation that you heard about, and I have to tell you it's a little aggravating to be the 7%. If there is a problem, one would think one would start with the larger number of whatever problem that might be, as opposed to the lower number. We support more information. We support more studies. We think that the department could use more resources. We think that to regulate the withdrawals in the absence of knowing what's down there to begin with gives you the numerator but not the denominator. And as you've already heard, unless you're going to go out there and meter water wells in the rural areas, and by the way, I'm busy that day when you decide to do that, that won't really tell you much. What is necessary is for advanced data, studies, on aquifers, the very complicated issue of ground hydrology, not this sort of approach. We do not support the bill. The number, as you've heard from many witnesses, 15,000 gallons a day is arbitrary. There's no particular benefit in substituting a different arbitrary number. I think what we ought to be doing is what we talked about last session and what we'll be doing hopefully in the future is giving the department the tools, if it needs, whether financial or legal, to actually do the studies to find out what is happening in Oregon's groundwater resources. The last thing I want to mention, Mr. Chairman, because I know time is short, I would strongly encourage the committee to separate land use concerns from water concerns. They are different. They often masquerade as one another. To the extent that the issue about rural development is truly a water issue, in other words, where there is a lack of groundwater or well interference, something else, that is properly a water discussion. To the extent that rural development is seen as overloading roads or somehow in some other fashion undesirable, that's probably a land use discussion. And it does not neither legal and policy discipline justice to conflate them. They obviously relate. But they are totally separate, and they're analytical tools. I think what has given rise to this issue, as in most parts of Oregon, is a land use conversation, not a water one. And to that extent, not only is this perhaps not there's a committee meeting next door that might handle that, but it's also, I think, you're approaching the problem from the wrong angle. If what you're trying to do is get at rural subdividing or rural land development through water, you probably ought to talk about the rural subdividing or development. With that, I'll conclude. Be glad to take any questions.
Thanks. Representative Berger.
Thank you. I'm a little bit distressed to think that you may arrive home tonight and have to put your waders on.
I live in heavy clay soils. After the rains we've had, the waders are kind of a to go out with the goats.
It's a normal thing.
Yes, sir.
All right. What powers should the department have, in your opinion, in order to get going with the process of doing a job of managing this scarce resource? I think you sort of glossed over it real fast, and I'd like to know if you have any further thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnett, I might have done that. You weren't supposed to notice. I think the statutory authority they have is adequate. What
I
they
thought
need.
You might say that.
Well, but let me conclude. I'm not trying to be flip. There's probably a more thankless job in state government, Oregon, or other places than running the state water department, but I'm not sure what it is. They get slapped badly by this body on a routine basis, no matter what they do. Some room to work would probably be appropriate. I don't know how one gets that. That's a political issue. But I've watched the water directors come in here and get their heads beat flat by your colleagues and previous legislators for doing their job. Not that this body would ever do that, of course, because that's inappropriate. They have tools on the books. This is a very controversial subject. Anything you do with water outside of a deeply developed urban area is going to be controversial. And again, I'm not trying to solve for that political problem, but I think they have the authority they need. What they need is support from this legislature, maybe some clearer direction from this legislature, maybe some other, maybe working on an intergovernmental basis with local governments to help them at the city and county level. I don't know how you'd fix that. But I'd defer to the department if they think they need specific statutory authorizations that they do not currently have. My take on it, not that they've asked me to speak on their behalf, my take on it is they have the tools. They just simply need to be given the direction and authority to implement them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Representative Barnhart. And thank you both for being here. And we're going to move on to the next hearing. Just a quick comment from the chair. I, you know, heard from a lot of folks today. This was very interesting, and heard from a lot of folks that the argument that because this only represents 7% of our total water use, groundwater use in the state, this is not, you know, an issue of serious concern. And frankly, I find that argument just terribly unconvincing. I mean, this committee, if it's doing its job, is looking at the whole 100% and examining what's, you know, important and beneficial, and where are places where we can conserve or reduce our use or change our laws accordingly. We spent considerable time talking about water reuse, gray water reuse, that will represent something less than a fraction of 1%, but nevertheless is an important part of, you know, it's one piece of what we hope is a much larger effort to conserve and reuse and use appropriately. So just comment from me. Representative Smith.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment, Mr. Chair, and I want to offer another comment. It is, the testimony was helpful. I think we're probably all trying to come to grips with this. And heard the testimony that this was potentially de minimis use. And I suppose that very often that's true, but if I have a well that has a water right, or if I have a water right, and the water level is lowered by unregulated use, and that has some impact on a water right that I have in due course, then I do wonder how we should think about that, and I do also wonder if that at some point could be the subject of lawsuits that would be uglier than even ugliness we might have to deal with here. And I already have, you know, my compatriot and I are already engaged in a water discussion that is very important to us, and, you know, want to be careful with how many of those we engage in. But I do think that there's something important here to consider.
Thanks for your comments. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2859 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2675. Colleagues, we're changing subjects entirely, and I think to help us adjust to the change, we have our good colleague, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative, if you want to bring up anyone else to join you, or
there will be several people who will be coming up after me. That's
very good.
Great. Come on up. For the record, I'm Carolyn Tomei. I represent House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2675, which authorizes counties to establish a tree-cutting moratorium while they consider adopting a tree ordinance. You should also have the -1 amendment. I represent parts of Clackamas County, and as you know, Clackamas County has large sections of unincorporated urban areas. Clackamas Town Center and its surrounding development is a prime example of this. Advocates and constituents came to me during the interim requesting House Bill 2675. This bill is intended to give counties a tool they need in order that they need in these rapidly urbanizing areas. If a county wants to consider a tree ordinance, this bill gives them the authority to declare a tree-cutting moratorium while that ordinance is under consideration. It is totally permissive. If they want to do it, they may. It does not require any county to do anything. Also, the only intention here is to give counties a tool in these rapidly developing urban areas. There's no hidden agenda. We have worked with the Oregon Department of Forestry and at their request have added the language within an urban growth boundary. Moreover, we've talked with the Oregon Small Woodland Association and incorporated their suggestion of exempting lands under the special farm and forest assessments. And these also are contained in the Dash 1 Amendment, and I hope that you will adopt them. Colleagues, when you look at this measure, think of the Clackamas Town Center and its surrounding areas. These are growing urban areas, and our county needs tools to protect the urban forest and the watershed areas. And now I'd like to introduce Susan Chan of the Urban Green, who will talk more about this bill and the important role that trees play in protecting the Oregon urban environment, and answer any questions you may have. And I also have letters from the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, the Audubon Society of Portland, and the Sierra Club, all in favor of this bill. And I will leave to attend to other businesses. I know, Representative Gellinas, I know you hate to see me go.
I do.
I know, but I've got to, and I'll see you tomorrow afternoon.
Any questions before you go?
Oh.
You have a serious question, Representative Gellinas. No,
he does not. I didn't think so. Susan will be able to answer your questions much better than I am. I'm going to leave you in good hands.
Thank you
all so much. I guess if you have any quick questions, I'd be glad to answer, but she is going to be the better authority on these issues.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My God, you guys have quite the job. Appreciate your work. My name is Susan Shawn, and I'm here representing Urban Green. A quick comment on Urban Green. We're a citizen advocate or activist group that started in Clackamas County. When we proposed to Clackamas County last year in January that they consider a tree conservation ordinance, we had the support of, we figured, close to 4,000 people. When you get a copy of my testimony on the second page, which is on the back, you'll see the endorsements that we got at that time from every environmental organization that exists practically in Clackamas County, as well as a number of civic and political groups, including the I'm having a brain warp. League of Women Voters were supporting it too, and all the local CPOs in that area. So Clackamas the Clackamas County Urban Green is a small group, but we represent a lot of people. The history of the bill is that in January of last year, we went before the Board of County Commissioners in Clackamas County requesting a tree conservation ordinance. We noticed that we were rapidly losing the tree canopy in Clackamas County in the urban and unincorporated areas. Some of the cities have tree conservation ordinances already, like Wilsonville and like Oswego, but the unincorporated areas do not. And so when we went to propose this tree conservation ordinance, we tried to get a moratorium at that time. The fear was that we'd put this on the table and then people would clear cut in anticipation of this ordinance passing. We were told at that time that we could not do a moratorium because of the way the State Forest Practices Act is written. So this bill is an attempt to provide that tool that we needed at that time. The tree ordinance for Clackamas County, just so you know, there's been a task force assigned to look into that, and it's kind of making its way through the task force process. So that's kind of the history of how this bill came about. What it will do will provide a moratorium on primarily clear cutting in Oregon counties from the time a county has a tree conservation ordinance proposed and the time that that ordinance is adopted. It's not permanent. It's a temporary moratorium. The areas that are addressed are urban unincorporated. So all of the timberlands, for example, in your district, Representative Gilliam, would not be affected by this. The farmlands and timberlands would not be affected. So, let's see. The benefit of trees, when you get your packet, the Audubon Society drafted a letter in support of this bill. And one of the things that they wrote that I didn't know and I found pretty astonishing, actually, is that in Portland, they had a study done, and it says the annual environmental services provided by the urban forest exceed $38 million a year. So we're talking stormwater management, we're talking shade, we're talking heat assistance, all those things that trees do. Overall watershed health is something I'm sure you all are aware of. The trees provide that. The Sierra Club letter also had some information that was new to me. I am not knowledgeable about carbon storage or sequestration. I don't even know how to pronounce that word, but on the second page, they talk about how the crucial role of what he's calling forest lands, we call it urban canopy, it mitigates the effect of climate change, basically, by storing carbon. So that's why we are so passionate about our tree ordinance and all the ordinances in the rest of the county. There are a few amendments that didn't get mentioned I want to make sure you are aware of. When I talked to Charlotte Lehan, who is now on the Board of County Commissioners for Clackamas County, she mentioned that hazardous trees need to be exempt from this. So if you're a utility, for example, you're going to want to be able to cut trees during that moratorium time. And if you have private property with a hazardous tree, that's something that so we accept that amendment. The Audubon Society requested that the temporary...
Let me interrupt for a moment. Is that amendment in the -1 amendment that we have before us, or is that an additional amendment that this bill would need?
The hazardous trees?
Yes.
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't see it in the -1s. I just wanted to...
So is there a formal way to do that?
Yeah, so we can work with you on an amendment. We'll hear. It looks like there are some other folks who may be able to address
okay,
that.
Okay, I think the person from the county is here for that.
Yeah, if you could go ahead and wrap up your... I'm sorry,
okay,
I got to rush you.
But 2 seconds. Okay. The Audubon Society wants the temporary moratorium to apply to industrial and institutional zones within the urban growth boundary. So, for example, like Carolyn was mentioning, the Clackamas Town Center, those trees need to be protected as well. And I think I'm done. Well, if you have any questions.
Thank you very much for being here today and for your work. Clearly,
thank you. You're
highly
welcome.
Committed work to this issue. So
thank you.
Thank you. Let's hear next from Rob Merch.
Somebody left a briefcase over here, by the way.
Sue Marshall, thank you. And
yeah, sure.
Jim Austin.
Hi.
Oh, I think that goes to the laptop. I think that belongs to the laptop.
I was kidding.
Yeah, sorry.
I didn't really want it. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. My name is Bob Murch. I will probably duplicate a little bit of what Susan said, but basically I also am one of the founding members of Clackamas County Urban Green. And in particular, currently, I guess I'm appearing in that regard, and also I think I can speak on behalf of my position as part of the tree conservation task force appointed by Clackamas County Board of County Commissioners to develop a tree conservation ordinance for the unincorporated areas of Clackamas County within the urban growth boundary. That's an ongoing project, and we're about a third of the way through at this point. For the last 10 years, Clackamas County has undergone rapid and commercial and residential development. Our unique urban environment has changed dramatically through clear-cutting of land as part of the development activities. While we see the need for development, we also understand the importance of smart development. More now than ever, preserving and protecting our trees from unnecessary destruction is critical to the long-term health of our planet and the sustainability of our urban environment. We've lost too many beautiful cedar, fir, maple, redwood, oak trees. Whole areas of seriously endangered historic oak savanna have disappeared in the name of unrestricted development. Perfectly healthy historic trees, hundreds of years old, are now gone. And with a significant loss of urban trees has come loss of wildlife habitat, tree canopy critical to helping control heat in this period of global climate change is important. Filtering out air pollutants, helping absorb greenhouse gases, maintaining property values, adding to aesthetic values of commercial and residential properties, and helping our efforts to retain and manage water are about a few of the benefits of a healthy urban forest. During the past 2 years, I've met with a number of groups doing presentations and listening to concerns people had with regards to preserving our urban trees. The message I heard time and again was we had to do something about before we lost all of our beautiful urban forests. These concerns are well documented and motivated us to bring this matter before the county commissioners, as you've heard before in Susan's testimony. The idea was endorsed to create an ordinance, and it wasn't a question of will we have an ordinance. We will have an ordinance. Just exactly how it's to be worded is part of our responsibility as a task force. Clearly, some people looked at this project as an infringement of their property rights. These people say that if anybody interferes with their rights to do what they want with their land, they will simply cut down all the trees to avoid any problems before the restrictions are enacted. And I've heard from developers who do not live within within the area affected by this ordinance. Their only concern seems to be related to maximizing profits, minimizing development expenses, stopping government interference with their God-given right to do whatever they want with their property. They seem to harbor a relatively narrow view of the world today and not one represented by the majority of the Clackamas County citizens. The published literature throughout the nation on the subject of urban tree preservation warns of the need for legislation to create a moratorium while the tree conservation ordinance is up for consideration. Research done by such groups as the Environmental Law Institute of Washington, D.C., in a book titled Nature-Friendly Ordinances, encourages restrictions related to moratoriums and penalties needed as part of the ordinance creation process. Without such restrictions, the door is open for the destruction of trees that should be the subject of evaluation and possible preservation or protection.
Mr. Murch, yes. We have your written testimony here,
yes.
And I'm going to ask that you summarize the remaining and maybe 20 or 30 seconds, and we'll try to squeeze in the other witnesses on this topic.
I will. And the issue, I guess, that we dealt with is the fact that the county can't enact any type of ordinance that would unilaterally restrict trees being cut in a clear-cut manner, and the Forest Practices Act basically spells that out. So that's what this is why we were forced to come to the state legislature to enact some legislation to provide those interim protections. And I guess one of the issues that I focus on is the importance of trees with regards to water management, which obviously is part of your responsibility. And the retention of surface water management, retention of groundwater is also extraordinarily important. We see it as a benefit of trees and protecting the precious water resource. So your approval of proposed legislation will allow local governments the opportunity to temporarily preserve trees while consideration is being given for effective long-term tree conservation ordinance. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll jump in. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Audubon Society of Portland and their 10,000 members. I believe you already have received our testimony, and actually I'd like to thank Susan Sean for summarizing our testimony, but we'll just hit on a couple of points. We think this is a very important piece of legislation as it allows jurisdictions the opportunity, if they elect, to set a temporary moratorium while they're developing a tree cutting ordinance and determining how they would like to protect mature trees and important tree groves and how they're integrated into the urban design. As has already been mentioned, in particular, the Portland metropolitan region has been looking at the economic value of tree canopy and have found that even a 1% increase in tree canopy translates to property value increases, whether or not those trees are on your property, somewhere between $200 and $1,400. Other folks have mentioned the ecosystem benefits. Those are real and important. We would like to see the inclusion of industrial and institutional land use zones in this tree protection, as they are important in developing a beneficial work environment, and actually it's been found that in hospitals where there's trees available that people heal more quickly. This is one step in what is a larger problem of protection of urban forest, and the Audubon Society of Portland would like to extend their support for whatever efforts to address the broader issue that the legislature, state and local government would like to pursue. But we very much appreciate your support of this bill.
Thanks, Sue. Go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, Jim Austin, Clackamas County Community and Legislative Affairs Department. I'm actually here in testimony to testify in support of 2675 and also the amendments. I've taken a look at the amendments. I think they make sense and they're needed. If you're a tree farmer, if you're an orchardist, you should still have those, be able to have those trees in your property and manage them in a way that's helpful. And with regard to Susan's discussion or mention of safe trees, Commissioner Lehan was concerned with that, having some provision for taking care of hazardous trees. But if I may, the bill that's before you is really just addressing would allow the county, of course, to do a moratorium while they're looking into doing a tree ordinance, which we are indeed looking into. We've got a task force on it. The moratorium would mask what, if I'm reading this correctly, would mask what would be in the ordinance. So it would be... I imagine in our ordinance that there would be something, some provision in there for taking care of hazardous trees. We wouldn't want anybody who has a 100-foot elm tree that's diseased and hanging over their house to have to keep it there because it creates a little cover. So I don't know if you feel that that actually needs to be in here or if that can just be, that would just be addressed in an ordinance since this just masks the ordinance.
Well, I want to let you conclude your testimony if you have anything else to add, but I do, I mean, I have questions and concerns about the whole sort of process taken in this bill or approach taken in this bill. So go ahead and...
Okay. And there's one other thing that brings up a question, and it's in the first section. It says, if the governing body of a county introduces a proposed ordinance, I don't really know what, for the purposes of starting the clock for the 1 year or for the duration of the moratorium, there's a couple of options. If we were to draft an ordinance, we would have to send 45 days prior to starting that process. We'd have to send notice to DLCD, so you could start the clock there. You could start the clock when the first hearing is on the proposed ordinance, or you could start the clock when the notice of the proposed hearing for the ordinance is. So either one of those would be fine, but I think that just needs to be defined. So when we start the clock on that one.
So I want to explore, and we don't have much time, but I do want to explore the approach this bill takes because it's an interesting one. It as I read it, it would apply a moratorium that would match, as you say, the proposed ordinance at the time the ordinance is introduced for consideration. The reason for consideration, of course, is to ensure that you get a better product, right? To make sure that you get a product that takes into account, for instance, of the hazardous trees issue. My concern and sort of curiosity about this is related to, you know, that issue, for example, that perhaps doesn't show up in the proposed ordinance. It sounds like it would in yours because mm-hmm. you've considered that issue, but one can imagine a community that says, oh, we're going to have a tree-cutting ordinance, and they introduce it. A moratorium, according to this bill, follows, and it's a blanket moratorium that begins without the kind of deliberation and consideration that comes along the public process. It's just this would be a kind of curious approach to law or rule or ordinance making, if you get my drift, to apply a moratorium before kind of public process, before public deliberation, and there are reasons for those things. So I'm open to this, mm-hmm. but need to be convinced that we're not doing something quite strange in this bill.
Yes, correct. Well, I'd argue that with the Clackamas County Tree Task Force, which is an open process right now, and you're meeting with other groups in the community right now, some of this is being, I mean, when they bring a recommendation to our board, which would be the organization or the governing body that actually adopts it, there's a lot of deliberation and discussion with community groups that would have gone on prior to that. What this bill is trying to get at is people who are trying to jump the gun and start.
I understand the concern, and I think it's a real concern, and that we should try to find a way to address it. And mm-hmm. As I said, I'm open to this possibility, but again, like the analogy to the lawmaking process of the state, when someone introduces a bill, that bill does not take effect until the legislature has had time to consider it, vote on it, signed by the governor, and then even then, without an emergency clause, doesn't go into effect for some time. And the idea that a moratorium would be applied that matches a bill that's merely been introduced strikes me as unusual, and you know, I understand the point and the concern that you have, but I do want to sort of hear more about this just from a process standpoint.
I might add one thing. I reading some reference material on that. I've seen common moratorium to be just a blanket moratorium, not referencing any particular ordinance, but that if an ordinance is up for consideration, there will be no tree cutting, period. Doesn't have any details or anything. It doesn't really require you to reference back to an ordinance that hasn't been yet approved. It just says once the process begins, then the moratorium is in effect until the process is completed. This one refers back to, you know, the ordinance itself. It would be consistent with whatever the parameters of the ordinance were, but as you say, the ordinance hasn't yet been approved, so that's a subject of discussion.
Yeah, I find it very interesting. Representative William.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. You know, I love your motivation. My parents moved to the top of Mount Scott in 1971, and it looks a little different than it did in 1971. And I lament that coming up to 2005. But to the chair's point, if we get into a precedent here of preempting those that are making the law, you sort of supersede it. And I appreciate the exemptions mentioned earlier when I think about my district for tree farmers and for other kinds of landowners. But property rights are a huge issue, and the testimony characterized, I'm sure, accurately some. But what about those that don't fall in that extreme category, who aren't threatening to clear-cut, if you even mention anything, they'll clear-cut their property? What about those that are in an integrated policy, kind of a point of view, that they want to save trees and have a development that is has both sides of those? I fear that we put additional burden on them through something like this. And the last question I sort of would have, and it is not a question about anybody in Clackamas County, but what if those that have other motives were in collusion, and the moratorium versus the city ordinance, and somehow things just go on and on and on, and they don't come to a conclusion, either by collusion or by ineffectiveness, and it goes on forever. You have a lock on a process with this proposal, I could imagine. So those are some of my thoughts, and I'm, I don't know if there's a question there, but you're welcome to.
Well, I think you've hit a number of concerns that we also have. It is difficult. A moratorium concept is difficult. There's no question about it. The literature that I've read tends to support the concept of a moratorium, and I can tell you that I've had people approach me saying they're just not going to wait for something to happen to curtail their ability or limit their ability to remove the trees. They're going to remove them as soon as they have a heads up that this is going to happen. I think the crafting of the words probably is going to be difficult, and it may have to be examined again in with regards to what you said. But I think you've made your point.
Well, I can sort of partly respond. If I understood you correctly, Representative Gilliam, this moratorium would expire under this bill, would expire a year after the introduction of the ordinance.
It couldn't go on forever.
It couldn't go on forever. I think there was a sort of more general point you were making as well. But it would not be possible for the moratorium simply to just be on the books for decades.
Point taken. What if you have another moratorium about the same area, and you start the clock again for another year?
Right, and I think there's a provision to try to deal with that as well. Do you want to bring that up?
Yes, again, for the record, Jim Austin, Clackamas County, Chair Cannon. It's a Section 1, Sub 3, and there's a fill-in-the-blank here, and I believe the amendments say 3 years, so a governing body of a county may not impose another moratorium under this section to which a previous moratorium applied within 3 years after the termination of the previous moratorium. So there would be a three-year window. You couldn't, and I would completely agree that having a failed attempt or a recall or something that derailed that process, and then just stringing several moratoriums all together and having a de facto tree cutting ordinance would not be fair, and that would not be what we would intend to do as well. So I think that's why that provision's in there, and the Dashwood amendments, I believe, have a 3 year window between them. So.
Oh, great. We're short on time, as you know. Thank you very much for testifying again. I think this is trying to go after a very important and real issue, and hope that we're able to find a way to get there. We're going to finish with Mr. Chandler and Laurel Hines, and I'm going to keep you. We're taking advantage of my committee's good graces, and hopefully the speaker and the chief clerk aren't watching as we go over our allotted 2 hours. So, briefly.
Okay. Again, my name is Laurel Hines, and I didn't have anything printed. I wasn't planning to talk on this, but the bill sounded so important I decided I should say something. I belong to the Arbor Day Foundation, and I get a lot of information. I read a lot about trees and about how the tree canopy helps the environment and the heat in the city and all kinds of things besides just being pleasant to look at. And I wanted to point out that I really think that the reason for a moratorium is that, as was discussed, when an ordinance is being considered, sometimes landowners go out and clear-cut all their trees. And we're dealing with an issue of irrevocable damage here and cutting down of trees of maybe 100 years' growth or more on some of the old oak trees. And the Arbor Day Foundation points out that most of the aged trees that have been cut down in cities have been replaced with very small trees, some of which will never get big, never provide very much canopy, never provide much heat reduction, that sort of thing. And if you see maps of where, huge maps of cities where the canopy is cut down, it's just horrifying when you consider climate change issues. And I really think that we need something like this to prevent that irrevocable damage before it's too late on any large areas of trees still left in cities. So I think it's very important and not a trivial thing. And by the way, the woman sitting next to me, who I hadn't met before from League of Women Voters, I believe, said that this bill was already dead on arrival. I hope that isn't true, because I think it's a very important bill, needs very important consideration, and I hope you don't give up on it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, John Chandler for the Oregon Home Builders Association. We're not supportive of House Bill 2675. we are supportive of tree ordinances. In my career, I've helped write many of them for local governments. They're very problematic. A lot of balancing is involved. We have an urban growth boundary system that requires certain density targets within those boundaries. Trees and density don't always go well together. There's a lot, as already we've heard, about the climate issues, the drainage issues, all of that need to be wrapped into those discussions. I also understand the concern at the local level about people who will go out and cut their trees in advance of an ordinance, and I don't support that. We've always instructed our folks, don't do that. It's wrong. It's bad press. You don't need to do it. Work with the local established policy. Having said that, I've been sitting here trying to figure out how on earth this would work. There is a moratorium statute in the books in Oregon. It's an ORS-197. I don't recall the exact reference. It's a land use action. As with all land use actions, if this would, I assume it would amend that statute, although it doesn't say that, you have to give notice. Once you give notice, the bad actions people are worried about may take place. And I understand the need and I understand the desire to say, as of this moment, you can't cut another tree, but you have to tell people that there's going to be that moment. And it gets very circular very quickly, I'm afraid. The other concerns I have are that if we get into the working of the bills, what about existing developments under approval? What about projects that are in the pipeline? I don't know the intricacies of the Forest Practices Act. That would deserve some more discussion. There are some takings issues presented here by even temporary moratoria. Under the current moratorium law, the existing moratorium law, that's very strictly construed. There's a lot of timelines and deadlines and requirements of local governments in order to declare a moratorium. This bill doesn't address any of those. Included in that is the protection of property owners whose expectations are affected by the declaration of a moratorium. That's, I understand, is also a controversial issue, but not one that ought to be glossed over. I'd be more than happy to work with Representative Tomei. I didn't get a chance to talk to her before the hearing. If there's things we can do from the industry standpoint to help with this, if it's a development problem, I might be able to help out. If it's a property owner problem, that's a different conversation. But I understand the need, but I'm struggling with how the bill would be implemented in a way that accomplishes the desires of its proponents without at the same time doing a fair amount of damage to our existing structure, existing processes. Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude with that. If there's any questions, I'll be more than happy to take them.
Thanks.
Any questions?
I don't think so. Thanks very much for being here, for your testimony. With that, we're going to go ahead and close 2675. And committee will be hearing amendments to proposed amendments to the bottle bill legislation. I think it's 2184 on Thursday. You should receive those amendments by email tomorrow, as will the public. So those will be available for you to review, and we'll be prepared to hear testimony on those and possibly adopt some of those amendments on Thursday. Thanks very much.
Good.
With that, I will close the House Committee on Environment and Water.